So the deal is that there's a gong 5 minutes before, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. And then it confused me too. I sat there going, what's she doing still talking? Did she hear the gong? Would I have to get up and throw her out of her chair in this part of the roundhouse thing that I hadn't heard about? But yeah. So,
thank you, Ruth.
Oh, well, thank you, yeah. So, Ruth, tell me what you do.
Well, I'm a poet. Mm-hmm. I write poems. I've just written down that space smells like gunpowder. It's great. But I'm also, I wanted to start with your science fiction thing. You showed me something I'd never realized before. Of course, it's obvious that science fiction is about how our relation with technology might change ourselves and the world. And I can see that, you know, that goes back to Jekyll as well as Mary Shelley, mm-hmm. Jekyll and Hyde. But the science fiction writer I've always loved was John Wyndham. Mm. And, you know, those, the Kraken Wakes, more than any, I think, is this book. But it's not really about our technology. It's about given one change to the world, how we all behave. It's a kind of moral fable, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, in fact, Kraken Wakes is the only Wyndham I haven't read.
Oh, sorry.
We could talk about Triffids and the Cuckoos for a long time, yes. But I haven't read Kraken Wakes.
Oh, well, check it at Amazon.
I will.
But I think it's a wonderful book because it's about something outside there is trying to make a contact with us.
Right.
And there are fireballs going into the sea and people think they're wonderful. And then they disappear, and then things start to happen. And people call them the Bathys, mm-hmm. and they don't really believe it's happening. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, everybody, and it's set during the Cold War, so America and Russia both sort of bomb the deep sea places, so the Bathys get cross, and so they start them. And there's a wonderful image in it of somebody, everything, they flood everywhere. The ice cap, surprisingly, and it's a futuristic thing, but it's not due to our own technology. It's a study in how people behave when they react badly and the world goes wrong against them.
So I think that Wyndham's work, I mean, I hadn't read Kraken Wakes, I'd read practically everything else. I think Wyndham's work circles apocalypse. And he's really, he is just going around and around the idea of apocalypse. And this sounds like it too. And I guess in some cases, so he explores endogenous reactions to exogenous apocalypse, which is Triffids.
That's beautifully examines, put, yeah.
He examines exogenous reactions to endogenous apocalypse, right, which is like what our survivors do after the nuclear war, like Midwich Cuckoos, yeah. and so on. But he is, and this sounds like endogenous apocalypse, or exogenous apocalypse, endogenous reaction, right? So that the Krakens are the apocalypse, and what do we do? But apocalypse, the techno-apocalypse, I think, is a really interesting moment in our... And we're going through it again now with global warming in our history. I think about history as having two periods: the pre-Enlightenment period, which is essentially lapsarian, right? We're moving away from the garden. Things are getting worse, and it's easy to understand biologically why people would feel like things are getting worse, because as time goes by, the flavors become less intense, the sounds become less intense, your bones ache more, and surely the world, it's the world and not you. Surely the world isn't as sweet as it was 50 years ago.
Well, that goes right back to Hesiod. I mean, the idea of there's a golden age, and all the men were wonderful, then there was a silver age, then there's a bronze age.
They say the golden age of science fiction is 12. So that's the pre-Enlightenment. And then post-Enlightenment, there's this idea of progress, right? Standing on the shoulders of giants, things will get better and better and better. But I think the brain cries out for an end. So the end of things that get worse is apocalypse. The end of things that get better is a kind of rapture, you know. But both of them are endings.
Well, we're story-shaped creatures.
Yeah. So we want a climax and a denouement, you know. So, yeah.
But it's very interesting because I've just recently written a book of poems about Darwin, Charles Darwin, and his family and his ideas. And he was in love with progress. He could afford to, you know, when he's in 1838, when he's writing in his notebooks, just before he gets the sort of insight into natural selection, he's working towards it. He reads Malthus and he says, well, you know, everybody, every animal, every human enshrines their history in that stub at the end of the tail. But instincts and desires, these have a history too. And, you know, things like anger and revenge used to preserve us. We don't need them now. We've become more civilized, you know. And so we try and contain these vestiges of our animal past.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, God, you could write that in 1838. You cannot write that in 2009.
Well, why couldn't you?
Because we don't. Who tries to contain it? Road rage. Containing anger is not one of the things that our society prioritizes, even here, let alone in...
But I think, actually, as much as ever, if not more than ever today, we think of our minds as being the uneasy relationship of the limbic animal brain and the rational human brain, and we strive to rationality.
Who's the we? You may, but you know a whole lot of. I've just had my pocket picked in Camden.
Look, oh wow!
I got off the bus.
How Victorian!
It was sort of extraordinary. It happened in 2 minutes.
Right.
Because I live up the road, and I wanted to see what they'd done. There was a huge fire in
Camden.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah.
And they've done some enormous black horses. Anyway, I was walking through there, and then I saw a coat for £10. I thought, whoa, I could buy that, and my purse wasn't there, and it was within 10 minutes.
Wow.
You know, and the people, that there's a, we are still a jungle.
Yeah, no, I agree, but we still, we, okay, so for example, think about weight loss, which is one of the great.
Okay, let's think about weight loss.
You know, we have this, we think of weight loss as being a struggle between our instincts and our rational mind. Our rational mind says the long-term value of this, you know, highly processed, you know, sugar, salt, fat is actually negative. But our animal mind says the short-term value is positive, and so we do these things in the short term that harm us in the long term. And it's, you know, it's the fodder not just of high-flown books for the intelligentsia. It's the fodder of every, you know, red-top tabloid. You know, I couldn't stop eating. I had a gambling problem.
I dispute that that's the animal mind. I mean, you know, most animals don't overeat. Animals in the wild don't overeat. They eat what they need, and then they stop. So maybe it's the human mind gone wrong rather than the animal mind.
The irrational mind, then. So we think of ourselves as beings who live on this uneasy truce between the rational and the irrational. You know, we talk about our lizard brain reacting and our fight or flight instincts and then being overcome by our cool rational minds. And wouldn't it be better if we could make decisions more rationally and so on? Rationality is a virtuous way of conducting yourself rationally. The irrational is pejorative. So I've just read a great book by Jonah Lehrer, who writes popular neuroscience books about decision making, and he's part of this new group of popular science books that I think of as Leeuwenhoekian. Leeuwenhoek invented the microscope, and there was like a century of science writing that's just things people saw in a microscope without even much analysis. It's just like, I found something else completely odd. Here's a drawing of it. And in the era of the fMRI, the functional magnetic resonance imager, there is, I think we're entering a century of fMRI literature, which is just, I put someone's head in a machine and asked them to choose whether they like black or red licorice, and here's what I found. I put someone's head in a machine and had them think about an extramarital affair, and here's what I found. And what he talks about is the idea that, in fact, when people suffer an insult to a part of their brain that's right here behind the eye, that's emotional, they lose the ability to make decisions. Because when you ask them, you know, shall we meet on Wednesday or Tuesday, they can give you the rational reasons why Tuesday is good and why Wednesday is good, but they can't distinguish between them. They can't decide among them without an aesthetic, emotional response that isn't back here in the lizard brain. They talk about the brain as a palimpsest. You know, the historic notion of the brain is it's a palimpsest. And here we have the neocortex, the new bark. And as you peel away the layers, you get closer and closer to, you know, the first thing with a spine that crawled out of the sea. And in fact, it's not way down here that these emotions that cause us to be aesthetic and to respond and to function lives. It's right here. It's right here in the new stuff that emerged last, you know, and without it, we're dithering idiots. You know, would you like white sugar in your coffee? Well, sugar is sweet and I like sweet things, but sweet things are bad for you and they rot your teeth. And you can do this for 45 minutes while your coffee turns to sludge, you know.
Unless you're a scientist stealing the poet's sugar.
Yeah.
but I dispute this thing about, I think we need another language. Having all this menagerie in the neuroscience of our brain is not helpful. It's a bunch of metaphors, the lizard brain and so on. And I think the animals, people have always used animals to think with about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it might be helpful to have a whole bunch of other things, like quarks. I mean, when they discovered or invented quarks, they then attributed to them lots of adjectives like color and so on, which mm-hmm. were not really qualities of these quarks at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quantum physics is an area that's really fascinating to me, because as an engine for writing science fiction stories, it's great because most people, including me, don't understand it very well, don't have a good intuitive grasp, and it's an enormous distracting a carpet that you can sweep a lot of things under in your storytelling. There's a great American kids cartoon called Pinky and the Brain, and it's about these two mice that are always hatching world domination plans, and one of them involves this mouse impersonating an 11-foot-tall, rail-thin country western singer. And his explanation for how he got that way is that it involved a microwave. And they ask him why, and he says, well, no one understands what microwaves do, so they'll all believe it, right? And it works. And the same is true of quantum physics. And so quarks, I think, you know, quarks are quantum physics is one of those things where I read a great book, popular quantum physics book, and for 10 minutes I understand it. And then immediately I'm plunged back into Newtonian space. And I think that all these amazing adjectives we apply to quantum physics, like, well, to quarks, especially strange and their color and their spin and so on.
And lovely.
Are part of, they're meant, or they function anyway, to stop us letting them get normal again. They require us to think of, to continually remind ourselves that quarks don't work the way that everything that your intuition tells you.
But doesn't it work the other way too, is that you get habituated to these adjectives. So that's a strange quark, that's a scarlet quark, I don't know. And I'm interested in how the words work, and it does draw attention to what a metaphor is, what an adjective is, what a quality mm-hmm. is. I was interested in, because Margaret Atwood is your
fellow Canadian.
I was with her last night. She's just brought out this new book, mm-hmm. and all the reviews start off by saying, Margaret Atwood says she does not write science fiction.
Oh, yeah, I know.
But, you know, but then, of course...
Well, of course, she used to say she writes science fiction. Now she says that she was wrong before when she said she wrote science fiction. It's, in fact, literature.
Yes. But it is. She is so... Her mind is so large.
She's an odd duck. So I don't know her. And mostly what I know of her is in opposition to all the things that I care about. So she says she doesn't write science fiction, and I'm proud to write science fiction. She is a staunch... copyright maximalist. She called Canadian librarians the equivalent of car thieves. She said it's the moral equivalent of auto theft to loan out books in public libraries. So I actually don't know much about her, except that every now and again I'll just read something by her that totally infuriates me. I quite like her books, though.
Well, I want to go back to what you were talking about, half an hour ago, because this idea that you might go in at 14 and come out at 26 of the American education system, having never taken any intellectual risks. Because that's tragic, because often here we think that you're going to have a broader education in North America.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that that's the way it was prior to the hyperinflation. I don't know what it was. They kind of productized universities. So the university degree became a kind of a prerequisite for entering the workforce, and there was an inflation, a credentials inflation, and so universities started to badly react to larger numbers of applicants who had figured out how to make the numbers that they cared about go up. So my wife says any number you put on the wall goes up. I don't think that's original to her, but basically anything you measure will increase. So what you're measuring is generally a proxy for something else. We don't care about GDP because GDP is good in and of itself. We care about GDP because it's meant to be a proxy for the general health of the individuals who make up the economy. But of course, we've now discovered that it's possible by trading, options on options, on derivatives, on options, to make GDP numbers go up without generating any of the underlying value that GDP is meant to represent, in the same way that you can do things like make fat values in food go down without making them any healthier. So any number that you care about, there's a way to make that number change without the thing that the number represents changing. And great, basically, high schools and universities engaged in a kind of emergent conspiracy to make the numbers that constituted admission and success go up without the things that those numbers were supposed to represent increasing at the same time. And I think that that really has done terrible violence to the idea of a liberal education.
So sad. I was thinking again about Darwin, because he hated school. Mm-hmm. He did Greek and Latin, and it was very good for him, the Greek and Latin. Because I used to do classics, and I know that his writing is very good because he did Greek and Latin, but partly. But
well, he was such a Linnaean, right? I mean, knowing Greek and Latin is very handy if you're going to go around and name things.
yeah, but I was thinking more of his cadences and the grammar, the structure of his sentences. So he was a wonderful writer. But he at 16 he was you know he sort of his father gave up and sent him to university to medical school, and he hated that too, and he dropped out of that too. He couldn't stand the operations, and he found the lectures very boring. So, you know, aged 17 and a half, he had to go to his father and say, you know, I don't like this either. And his father despaired, and he said, you know, you're going to be an idle, good-for-nothing fellow. You're only keen on shooting and rat-catching. So what do you do with somebody like that? You send them to Cambridge to study divinity, which is what what happened. And then he was lucky enough at Cambridge to meet... Well, he did also at Edinburgh, actually, meet some great naturalists.
So I want to change direction slightly, because you've reminded me of something that I've really been chewing on. So I was in a car with my editor, and we were talking about a science fiction fan who had once been a promising writer, who has become a kind of caricature of himself. He's now a kind of, I guess, in his 60s. He's very bitter. He's very pedantic. He's really unpleasant, and he's kind of got a lot of spare time. I think he lives with his mom still, and he's on all the blogs, and he's always this kind of perpetual presence and very thorny and hard, but brilliant, right? Just a brilliant guy, like absolutely brilliant, but completely useless. And miserable, clearly just totally miserable. And I said, what do you think would have happened to those people 5 centuries ago, 3 centuries ago? He said, without thinking, he said, they would have gone to a monastery, right? These people who are not of or in the world, who are brilliant, but just not part of, you know, not able to participate in the social consensus. We had a place where they could go that wasn't their mom's basement. And I wrote a short story about it called The Things That Make Me Weak and Strange Get Engineered Away, about a kind of priesthood in a totalitarian state, and the priesthood manages the data for the totalitarian state. There are these kind of autistic spectrum.
But there were scientists too. I mean, let's go back to Leeuwenhoek. I don't know how you pronounce
it. I said Leeuwenhoek. You say Leeuwenhoek. I was taught by my instructor was Dutch. My science instructor was Dutch. So she said Leeuwenhoek.
Okay, so she's got the Ech thing. Okay. I mean, because there was a wonderful book, I don't know if anybody knows it, called The Microbe Hunters, mm-hmm. written in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And it started, and it was about the people who'd done the, really beautifully written. It was started with him. And he was pretty antisocial. He sort of beavered away in the back. He ground his lenses. And he looked at the, he filed off his teeth, and he looked at those, and he sent all those to the Royal Society here, I think, written in his sort of crab old Dutch hand. But he must have been a bit of a nerd.
Yeah, I think he was, right? And I think that, I think that that's historically been one of the things that universities have done as well, is they've been a place where you could be a kind of, you know, Asperger-y, kind of beardy-weirdy, who was really focused on something that to the point of you know, social and difficulty, but you could actually just chase it up and chase it down. And of course, it excused some terrible behavior. You know, I know people in the academy today who are really revered old PhDs who everybody cares about and leaders in their field, who are abominable to women and who are excused it all the time, excused it all throughout their whole career. No one ever calls them on it. And I think that was kind of the downside of that. Well, you know, you don't have to be in the world. You can be otherworldly and go off and chase
that goes
your
to poets, too. I mean, a lot of the history of that, too.
Yeah, and actually, one of my favorite examples of this is Shockley, who is the guy who invented silicon semiconductors. He's the guy who basically invented microchips, the transistor. And he was... they think maybe he had a stroke or something, because right around the time he won the Nobel Prize, he became an avid white supremacist and a eugenicist. And the thing was, he was really, really smart, and he was very persuasive, and he was really good at maths. And he basically went on a road tour arguing with geneticists and biologists about this view there's a genetic link that shows racial inferiority, and that furthermore humanity would get worse unless we started sterilizing the genetically inferior. But because he was so good at stats, he could actually argue circles around them. And because he was also a towering giant in his field who had created the microchip, no one wanted to say to he wasn't immediately banished to obscurity, right? He was also mad in other ways. He became very paranoid, started wiretapping his family. He wiretapped all of his employees. 8 of his original employees left his firm, which never produced a working microchip because he was too mad, and they went off and founded Intel. But today, Shockley, there's actually, even today, there's scandals around Shockley because the family, the foundation just endowed a park in Silicon Valley, and they want to put his name on it. No, he's dead, long dead. And he was an autopsy, but they want to endow a park and they want to put his name on it. And people are like, wait a second, you want to put his name on it? Yes, he's a Nobel Prize winner, but he was a nut job, you know, and a thoroughly objectionable one at that. Not the nice nut jobs that, you know, they think that they can talk to trees or something. This guy, he was a poisonous bastard, you know.
What would it have been like if he hadn't invented the microchip? Let's do reverse science fiction backwards. Mm-hmm. Supposing, what would our world be like if nobody had invented it? Would somebody else have invented it? Was it there, been waiting there?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that certainly there was a lot of people who were in love with gallium arsenide as the underlying material for arsenide as the underlying material for microchips instead of silicon. And he showed how to use silicon. Silicon's obviously a lot easier to find. It's sand, and it does, you know, and I think that's probably driven the speed at which it's improved. I don't know, though. It's an interesting question. I mean, the history of microchips is an interesting one, or semiconductors is an interesting one, because it also starts off as a thoroughly militarized discipline. And, you know, to some approximation, the people who were involved with it could only talk to each other because they were bound by state secrecy. They were working on defense contracts. And then there was this great commercialization, this big boom, where microchip production spread out to a whole bunch of competing firms. And these people were broken up, and they moved to all these different firms, and they could now talk to anyone except each other, because they worked for competitors. And none of them held in his head, and they were all, I think, almost all men, the knowledge necessary to make a microchip from the ground up. And there's a secret conference that I've been to one installment of in California every summer in Silicon Valley. It's a 3-day weekend, whose name I won't mention, and although it has a website, there are no links to it. And it started about 30 years ago as a place where people who worked in the semiconductor industry could go and violate their non-disclosure agreements. They would all get together and they would drink beer and do lightning talks, 15-minute talks, and talk off the record about the stuff that they weren't allowed to tell each other. And without it, there never would have been microchips as we know them today.
Would I have a mobile phone if Shockley hadn't lived?
I'm inclined to think so. I don't know. Maybe.
Do these people... They've got no connection to black helicopters.
To black helicopters? No, they're not. I don't think they're... It's not a conspiracy as much as it is the inevitable outcome of secrecy, which is that you always end up with a back door. You know, in the same way that systems administrators shut down your ability to, like, send attachments to people outside your institution, mm-hmm. and immediately everyone figures out how to get a Yahoo Mail account to send attachments, because the attachments need to flow, whether or not the systems administrators want you to. You know, spy masters say to their field operatives, you must not speak to your opposite number, but at the end of the day, everyone's got to, you know, kind of, you and the guy on the other side are the only ones who really understand what it's like, and so you strike up a kind of uneasy peace, you know. I think that always happens. Yeah. You know, I think it's one of the, like, repeating human stories. It's a great, going back to science fiction and fantasy, this great Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman anthology called what's it called? It just blew my. Does anyone know that their collaboration, Gaiman and Pratchett, Good Omens, and it's part of the premise is that there's a fallen angel and a devil sent from hell who have been on Earth, or an angel and a devil sent from hell who've been on Earth since the first war in heaven, and who are essentially opposite side spies from a Cold War that's been on for thousands of years, and the only people they can talk to is each other, and so they've become great mates over thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah, what would have happened if the idea that Satan was not a fallen angel, that he was not an angel at all, he was a different sort of creature, that's really informed so much of who we are, hasn't it? The idea that the devil isn't
just an angel.
It is an angel gone wrong.
Right. Well, tell me more about that.
Well, it's about our sense of our goodness and our badness.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Is our badness part of us, or has it fallen from? Is it our goodness?
Endogenous
gone wrong?
Or exogenous?
Exactly. We come back to the in what's coming in from the outside and what's coming up from the inside.
Yeah.
Of us, psychologically, emotionally,
and socially. Right. There's this whole. There's always been this notion of evil coming from the outside. You know, that when you hear about religious extremists in the papers today, they're almost always describing someone whose extremism is in defense of a religion that isn't the Church of England. You know, you rarely hear about religious extremists from the C of E, although there's surely some of them too.
There used to be something, I don't know if it still is, in psychology when I was sort of doing a PhD, called the just world hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And apparently there are, you know, you can measure, it seemed rather simplistic, but I'm sure the research is much more sophisticated now. Everybody wants to protect the idea, the hypothesis that the world is just. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you also want to protect the idea that you're good. So if you have a car accident, it's the other person's fault. But if somebody else has a car accident, probably they did something wrong. Mm. And so there's a whole lot of things about where does the fault lie, because you've always got to account for the fact that the world does go wrong, which is what the devil is.
So you know what fascinates me about this? Because obviously we are great fabricators of our own lives. You know, I think that as a technical matter, we don't store a lot of details as they occur to us. We reconstruct them based on probability. And there's lots of clever experiments that have shown that, you know, you ask people who've seen a video of a car accident, you know, what color, what was the man driving the red car doing? And in fact, it was a blue car. But the fact that you say it's red, they remember that it's red and mm-hmm. so on. We are now entering an era of universal surveillance. We're inhabiting an era of universal surveillance. 14 cameras per red blood cell in London now, and more every day. But there are lots of tools that are making us empiricists of our lives too. You know, there's the probably the most interesting and useful psychotherapy technique that has come into vogue is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is fundamentally about being an empiricist of your life, keeping logs of what happens. What you were thinking.
Turning us all into Lohenhock and the nerds in the back room of our lives.
Yeah. So here we are becoming empiricists, and to the extent that we're life logging what we're doing, what does that do to the just world hypothesis? You have a car wreck, and you see it, and you have this cognitive dissonance because you have your memory of it, and then you have the video of it, and you can see that you're clearly at fault. What do you do? Do you say there's some intangible thing that wasn't captured on the film that justifies what I did? I was swerving to see a pothole that doesn't show up on the video.
Yeah, that would be a lie.
Well, but that how's that? That I think a lie is just isn't always, but a lie can be just cognitive dissonance resolved, right? You don't. It may not be a lie that's intentional.
The trouble is with the cognitive behavior stuff is rather mechanistic. It doesn't allow for imagination.
No, it's right. In fact, it is intended to put pain to imagination, right? It's intended to correct the imaginative dysfunction that causes you, for example, to imagine that someone intended to give offense to you when, in fact, all they were doing was something that was just part of their normal round, and that the offense took place in your own mind, right? This is, you know, for people who are pathologically upset about everyone else giving offense to them deliberately, cognitive behavioral therapy helps them tame their imagination by applying empiricism to it.
Funny, and these things as correct and tame. It's as if something has gone wrong in a kind of moral way, or wild way, or a primitive. You know, there's all this stuff about correct and tame,
right?
Rather than release and explore.
Ah, yeah, that's a lovely point.
I'm sort of slightly skeptical about the sort of fashion for cognitive.
Well, certainly we're inhabiting an era in which empiricism is becoming a kind of fashion, as you say, where we're really, you know, I was saying before this notion of the fMRI becoming the ultimate tool. And I talked to a famous AI researcher about the artificial intelligence researcher, a guy named Marvin Minsky at MIT about it, and he said it's a distraction. The fMRI is an absolute distraction. 95% of what we see through the fMRI is apophenia. It's pattern. It's our brains imagining patterns.
Apophenia. How do you say it?
APOPHENIA. Right. It's our brains imagining patterns. We have developed a hammer, and now everything looks like a nail.
That means appearance away from appearance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's seeing a face in the cloud. Right. Okay. It's a pattern where none exists. You know. It's a dysfunction of the pattern recognition gland. You know. And he said, you know, when you have this tool that seems to show you everything, you will find conclusions in it where none exist, right? You'll manufacture them.
But you can't take it away because it's how we read the world, by seeing patterns.
Sure. Well, and that's the point, right? So for a long time, neurology was a lot like psychology in that it was a discipline that was mostly about detective work, right? It was about observing behaviors and then making guesses and then running experiments to see if the behaviors changed, but you treated the brain as a black box. I mean, you had EEGs, but they weren't very effective. They were very, very coarse. It's like measuring skin response, you know, galvanic response in the skin. Very coarse measurement. And now we have this much more precise measurement into the brain. And so, you know, I think to a certain extent, you have neurologists who are very relieved that suddenly they can be empiricists instead of soft scientists. They can join the ranks of the physicists and talk about numbers, you know, in the same way that quantitative economists are very macho about their equations.
There's always been this dream of hard science, that, you know, sort of the social sciences in the 70s, they wanted to. But in fact, you know, even hard science, it still depends on the observer.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, in social science, in sociology now, the advent of Facebook and its associated technologies has been the biggest boon to the bruised egos of poor sociologists of anything in history. You know, my mom's, her initial degree is in sociology, and my dad's a mathematician, computer scientist, and he's always poo-pooing her soft degree. But now you have sociologists who are like, look at this, I can go out and count the links between people. I can count how often they talk to each other. I can count how often they talk back. I can count the latency. I can count the diffusion, you know?
Wow, yes. I don't think the Facebook originators dreamed that they were...
Although, you know, researchers like Dana Boyd, starting with Friendster, soft scientists like Dana Boyd, who's now got a lab at Microsoft, have been in there as sociologists. She was Intel's first field anthropologist. Then she went to Facebook, and then Google, and Yahoo, and then I forget where she was just before she went. She was at USC finishing up her PhD when I was there, and now she has a lab with Microsoft. She's an amazing researcher. Her stuff is brilliant, but she's part of that wave.
It's interesting. I've just finished a sort of sequence of poems about sort of genetics, and I had to read a lot about cells. Mm-hmm. The first cell was this blue-green algae, and it was made probably not with DNA, but RNA. Mm-hmm. But the key to life is self-replication, mm-hmm. and that's what this is doing. This is what Facebook is. It's self-replication.
Yeah, it's copying. I mean, this is we haven't really talked about it at all. But you know, my other discipline here is copyright reform, and copying is we are the animal that copies. You know, like I remember when my daughter was born.
We aren't. Lots of animals copy.
Well, we are an animal that copies. Yeah. That copying is fundamental to what we are. So when my daughter was born, my mom came for a visit, and her other degree is in early childhood education. And she said, "Have you stuck your tongue out at her yet?" And the kid was like a week old. I was like, "Stuck her tongue out at her?" "No, of course not." And so she took my daughter in her arms, and she went, and my daughter stuck her tongue back out again. My daughter hadn't seen a mirror yet. She didn't know she had a tongue, but she copied it.
I've seen somebody at the zoo. There was a pygmy hippopotamus lying in a pool like this, and they live in. They know it's disgusting, but they like it like that.
Uh-huh, you know? Uh-huh.
Okay, and the keeper opened his hands like that,
huh.
And the hippo went.
Ha!
Huh. So the hippo was imitating the hands.
So you've just, because we're going to run out of time, you've just reminded me of my favorite Scientology story. So one of the things that the Scientologists have sued to have removed is an early edition of Dianetics, that in which Hubbard asserts that we spent several thousand lifetimes as bivalves, and that the thing that kills most bivalves is getting stranded with their shells separated on beaches. And that we have this terrible set of engrams that map to these thousands of lives we lived as bivalves. And that if you go to someone and you say, "This is a clam, and it's on the beach, and its jaws are open," that they'll panic. And they'll start saying, no, it's fine, it's fine. And if you persist, that they'll develop lockjaw. And so this early edition of Dianetics is one of the things that the Church of Scientology has used copyright law to have suppressed from the internet, because what they've done is just like the Soviets, who kept redacting Lenin through history to make his predictions more and more accurate. You know, the Progress Books, you know, the English language Soviet publisher, would put out new editions of Lenin once a year with modernized predictions.
New things Lenin had said.
And they the Hubbardites have done the same thing with Hubbard. You know, there's the modern This is one of the reasons that old editions of Dianetics are so valuable in the collector's market. This is why, that's why the big anti-Scientologist group is called Operation Clambake.
So he was an evolutionist, old Hubbard.
Yeah, I guess in a roundabout way. Well, he was a reincarnationist, but without any of the kind of lovely redeeming things that might accompany, say, Hinduism.
Yeah, yeah. But clams is pretty close to algae, isn't it?
Yeah.
Came from the sea. I mean, even though looking in Wikipedia about...
All right.
That's it.